This broadcast was actually released as the exclusive bonus show just for my patrons, those who support me on Patreon at patreon.com/SethAndrews. They get a commercial-free version of the broadcast, and then they get a bonus show. And the bonus show is usually a stream of consciousness monologue. Sometimes we will take calls, or perhaps we'll do a Google Hangout where people webcam in, and I'll release both the audio and video of those conversations just for the patrons every single month. And there is a video, a YouTube video of this particular monologue, which was recorded just a few days ago. But after reflection, I wondered if it might be a conversation relevant to the audience in general. And so, with the permission and blessing of my patrons, I'm releasing this show to everyone in the listening and potential listening audience. I hope it's a conversation you find compelling and interesting and engaging, something that relates to the climate that you and I live in. And perhaps it'll spur further conversation in your own circles about dialogue, discourse, connection, disconnection, ideas, actions, and reactions in our hyper-connected world. I hope you enjoy.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Brash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
You know, every month I try to do some kind of a broadcast just for the patrons. It's been so crazy busy lately. American Atheists is coming up this weekend. I'm writing a speech just for that. We're doing a broadcast from the stage. Hugh Laurie is the keynote speaker. It looks like there's going to be like 1,000 people there in Oklahoma City. They've had to upgrade the venue. They've had to move the venue across the street to the convention hall because of just... the response has been amazing. And so I'd themed the broadcast, I hope not too conceitedly, around my 50th birthday, which is coming up, and just a reflection on getting older and that kind of thing. And so I'm writing it, and it's a difficult balance because, you know, you want to make it personal and you want to be able to include anecdotes about your life, but you don't want it to be self-indulgent to the point where you're boring people to tears. It's like going to a party when someone only talks about themselves, you'd start to check out after a while, I want it to be a shared experience. And so it's always a cost-benefit thing whenever I'm writing a speech and there's an anecdote or, details about me and my life, and does it relate to other people and will they enjoy it? Will they take the journey? And it's not that I'm insecure about it. I mean, I've done enough public speaking that I know how to do public speaking, but still, kind of a big deal. But I'm honored to be a part of it. It's going to be a great weekend. Atheists.org has all the details if you want to be in Oklahoma City this coming weekend. I'm going up Friday night, and I'll be there through the entire weekend. So last night, we were watching, we're just killing time. It's storming around here. You know, we opened the doors and windows and just kind of listened to the rain and relaxed. And we finally decided just to sort of browse Netflix. And there is a series of interviews by none other than David Letterman of the David Letterman Show. You know, he retired from Letterman, from late night talk, and kind of went off. I guess he's very much an introvert, kind of an odd guy, you know. But he's obviously a, 50-year TV veteran. I think he's, 70-ish? He's grown this big beard. He's got this big sort of Dumbledore kind of beard. And he does these long-form interviews. He has a very cool kind of a studio audience thing. And he juxtaposes the formal interview where he's sitting across in a chair from whoever with sort of live man on the street stuff where he goes out and interacts with his interviewees and their hometowns and he meets their families and learns more about their stories. And the first guest was Barack Obama. It was a two-hour interview, and I was just mesmerized by the whole thing. Letterman, it took me a few to get used to the beard. It took me a while, because part of me thought, you know, he looks kind of crazy. I mean, something about him and the beard, I just wasn't jiving. David Letterman and I share the same birthday. Thank you. Well, Garath, yeah, I'll be 71. Okay, thank you for that. So, he has a very thought, I mean, as someone who's done a lot of interviews, not a, you know, to the degree that Letterman has by a long shot, but as someone who's done a lot of these conversations, it's an exercise in guiding and listening at the same time. It's there are a lot of pitfalls whenever you're interviewing someone that people fall into, and you'll I'm sure have seen a few of them. And I used to be guilty of this. I'd be so desperate of trying to maintain momentum that I was always interrupting the answer. Especially when I started in talk radio, somebody would be going and I'd be like, yeah, but what about this? You know, what about that? And I'd be jumping in at all times. And the beauty of podcast broadcasting is that you can take your time and you can do the long answer. You can take the journey. You're not looking at the commercial stop set fast approaching and the sponsorships have to be done at exactly this moment. And you just are on the clock and you just feel rushed. You get to really relax and go deeper and sort of, get into all these layers of the onion. And that's what, Letterman is really good at. I mean, he's really good at it. Not just the yuck David Letterman interviews that he used to do, but there is a compassion that exudes from this man that I had not previously seen. Now, I don't know what he is. I don't know who he is. I don't know anything about his life. I'm guessing, our value systems line up from the way he speaks over the shows that I've seen. But, he had on Malala Yousafzai, in which was the show we watched last night. Now, if you're not familiar with the story of Malala, I actually did a short video profile right after she was shot. She was a young girl in Pakistan. Her father and her were known nationally for speaking out for the education of young girls. And of course, the Taliban wanted to restrict education, keep girls sort of locked out of opportunities, keep them under the thumb, under the boot of the Taliban, under men of this patriarchal system. And Malala was gutsy. Now her father's telling her, don't mention the Taliban for your own safety. You know, go out and promote education, but don't mention the Taliban. And yet this 14-year-old girl would go out and hold these events, and she would call out the Taliban. She would just call them out. And she paid dearly for this. I think she was she 15 when she was shot? She's on a bus. A couple of guys from the Taliban get on the bus. One of them, a young man, asks, are you Malala Yousafzai? She says, yes. And he takes the gun, and I think he catches her right here at the temple. And the bullet goes down and just shreds the eardrum, severs the facial nerve. She should have died, but she did not. And you had to stop and consider, what kind of people would shoot a little girl? How insecure is an ideology if they go kill a little girl? This isn't a freedom fighter out there. They're not having, this isn't battle, even ideological battle. I mean, if they're going to go after, they're going after, how insecure are you to go after these little girls? And she recovered. She received asylum in the UK. And David Letterman sat across from her on stage and they just chatted. They just talked. And it's the first time I'd ever heard her speak at length. I've only heard sound bites, when she accepted the Nobel Peace Prize and when she's done the press conferences and given the speeches about allowing girls opportunities to go to school and achieve their potential and escape these sort of patriarchal prisons. And to have her sit there and just engage. And they talked in this amazing, empathetic, funny, very human way. If you have Netflix, check it out. This girl stole my heart. She just stole my heart. And it was interesting because, Letterman obviously was asking about the day she was shot. It's the day everybody's most curious about, what was that day like? You know, did they talk to you? And did you know it was coming? Were you afraid? And she doesn't remember it, which is typical of head trauma. Quite often you lose whatever, you know, events had happened around the time of the trauma. You just don't know. Those memories aren't implanted. And so she, in her mind, she had started the day and then she woke up in the UK, right? She just woke up in another country, not knowing what had happened to her. She didn't remember the shooting. She didn't remember this act of violence against her. But she volunteered that she had forgiven the man who shot her. She said, I've forgiven him. And I had to, you know, I've been chewing on that for a day. Could you forgive the person who shot you or your child in the face? I mean, just shot him. And her take is, and this is controversial, and this is kind of what I've been chewing on over the past day, and you tell me what you think in the comment sections here, but that he, in some ways, is a victim too. Armin Navabi of Atheist Republic has often stated this, and it's unpopular in some ways to say it. But, you know, those people who are members of ISIS, who are beheading and raping and killing and doing the most unspeakable of deeds, they're monsters and murderers, yes. But if we also see them as people who have been brainwashed by a horrific ideology, they are also victims, you know. When the radical goes to the Orlando nightclub and he kills, what did he kill, 80 people or whatever? And they talk about the victims. I think we as society don't want to validate this guy by also saying he's a victim. But if we are to be honest with each other, we have to say, how did someone get to the point in their life when they are so filled with hate and when they are so filled with rage and when they're taught by whatever, you know, they're taught to despise someone else, to loathe someone else so much that they would commit an act of homicide and even sacrifice their own lives. They had such a disregard for life in general. Their lives have also been stripped away from them too. I mean, imagine if that person had been raised in a family where love had been shown and people were taught to respect other people and were encouraged to explore and celebrate differences and to not be so tribal. And I don't know, we live in a culture where people speak in absolutist terms, and I understand why. If someone oppresses a woman in an Islamic theocracy, a fundamentalist theocracy like Saudi Arabia, which is finally starting to see a loosening, a little bit of a loosening, but this has such a long way to go. Malala can't even go back to Pakistan yet, her home, and yet she desperately would like to go set foot on that soil again. And you look at Iraq and all these places, you know, these men who are doing these unspeakably bad things, horrible things. In many ways, yeah, they're monsters. In many ways, they are, you know, they are so worthy of our contempt. Imagine, though, if they had not been trained by this ideology, by these governments, by this religion, by a father figure, hell, a mother figure, to embrace at all costs these horrible ideas. And they had been given the opportunity to genuinely live a life of love and acceptance and promoting and celebrating diversity. If you look at it in that point of view, they are in some ways kind of a victim too. I mean, their lives are wasted. They wasted their lives. For what? Magical thinking, quest for power, an insecure need to dominate other people, horrible ideas, bad ideas. it's not popular, you know, especially I'm from Oklahoma in very conservative circles. You know, they have a very black and white, A, B, binary way of looking at good and bad. You see somebody oppressing somebody else and, you know, they are evil and you are good. Good must defeat evil. You know, it's black and white. You can't reach them. You can't fix them. You can't teach them. You can't persuade them. Many people around here, anyway, here in the Midwest and Southwest say, you know, just wipe them off the map, start over kind of thing. I don't think I can remotely hold to that. I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, you're going to be able to talk ISIS out of beheading people. But I think, you know, we remain in a war of ideas as much as anything else. How do you, even Malala said it last night, how do you, you know, you can go and do battle against the actions and the deeds. But if the ideology remains in place, you're only swatting at the symptoms. I'm paraphrasing. I forgot exactly how she said it. And, you know, she amazingly came to a point in her own life when she said, I forgive the guy who put a bullet in my skull and came this close to ending my life. And I think, you know, if Malala Yousafzai can find a place where she can see past the deed and see into all the gears in the machine that created this kind of hatred, and she can reach forward to see this person as also a victim in some way, fighting the ideology, fighting the bad ideas, wanting to protect the girls, wanting to see them survive and thrive and succeed and excel. All those things are true. But beyond that, seeing that, you know, everybody loses. Everybody loses in this scenario. Then you are not just an advocate for the victims of violence, but you are an advocate to help rescue those who have been indoctrinated to carry out the violence. And I don't know, I've been chewing on that for a good part of the night. It's not a popular narrative. You know, there's a, talk about tribalism online, especially the era of social media, you know, it's, people are knee-jerking. They just, you know, we saw there was a murder-suicide that took place in San Antonio, Texas. I guess it was 3 or 4 months ago. And this guy was an atheist podcaster, and he hadn't exhibited, to our knowledge, any. I mean, I didn't know the guy. I think I'd met him a few times, but I don't know him. But I knew of him. And he, to our knowledge, didn't seem like a volatile guy. Didn't seem like he had anything but gentleness. I mean, you never know what goes on behind closed doors. You just never know. That much is certain. But, you know, he and his wife were breaking up. And she was unhappy, and she was heading out the door. And this guy went on Facebook and he just typed the word goodbye. And then he went home and he killed her with a gun, and he killed himself. And we did a show about this. And obviously she's the victim. You know, she's the one. She was just trying to live her life and be happy on her terms. She certainly doesn't deserve what happened to her, not remotely. You know, it's just, it's crazy. And in that way, yeah, he is a monster who committed a monstrous act. But when you stop and you also say, what led to that? How did this guy, who no one really, I mean, we not that I could tell from the people we interviewed, exhibited signs of any aberrant behavior. How did someone like that do this? And you begin to analyze and ask questions, and you see this, you know, what broke this person's perceptions? What made a previously peaceful person a murderer? What happened? And when you stop and you ask how the monster became the monster, right? How did the monstrous deed happen? There are some who immediately declare that you are insulting the victim by trying to humanize the monster. You're desecrating her memory and her life and her values and what she stood for. You're trying to distract her from her. And you're trying to equivocate and humanize an inhuman thing, you know. But, you know, this guy was, he was a person. I have no idea what gears are going on in that guy's head. Because in my mind, and I don't think this is naive, understanding why he did what he did. What are the things, the catalyst that drove this person to just snap and commit this unspeakable act of murder? If we understand it, can we not then better help prevent it from happening to someone else tomorrow? And that sounds trite on the surface, but I hold to it. Aren't we creatures of reason and understanding? Are we cheating the victim by trying to see and analyze the mechanisms that drove this particular murder? And yet there was a narrative online that if you were to stop and spend any time on the murderer, that you are making the murderer a victim. It's not really how I see it. It's almost like, you know, the Taliban. You know, there's something broken in that machine. Her life was certainly lost. His life was, it was lost too. I mean, it was obviously she's the one who had the crime perpetrated against her, and she's the one where our sympathies genuinely really should focus and lie. You have no argument from me there. But we're creatures of understanding. How did this happen? And why did the question of how did this happen become some sort of apologetic to excuse the murderer? Because that's the narrative that many people are selling out there. You try to humanize the inhuman. Well, you're simply making excuses for monsters, and you're part of the problem. Binary thinking. It's not just a religious thing. We see a lot of people who, it's all or nothing. It's 100% or zero. You are the hero or you're the villain. And, you know, I wonder if maybe we could learn from Malala. Is there something she could teach us about nuance and about perspective and compassion? If I can look at the person who's committing the beheading in, you know, Iraq and hold them in contempt and tremendously hate the deed, and I can also grieve that this person has been so broken, so brainwashed, so caught up in hatred, and genuinely seek, you know, a world where this type of thing can be fixed, where better ideas beat bad ideas. I don't know, if someone had shot a member of my family, you think I could forgive? Easy to say until it happens to you. What's your perspective on it? I'd be curious. Nuance is not exactly the currency of these discussions. Have you noticed? It's amazing. Was it Jerry DeWitt who posted on Twitter that we judge other people by their actions, but we judge ourselves by our intentions? I don't know if that's true or not, but I thought it's an interesting observation. You know, you watch somebody else and you're like, they did this. And yet whenever we're called or challenged, we'll say, well, I meant to do that, or I meant this by this. We judge them by action. We judge ourselves by intention. You think we could gain something by doing a better job of empathizing and trying to understand intention, what drives the machine? There's a video out there somewhere. Someone shared it with me yesterday. It was talking about, in fact, Obama mentioned it when he was talking to Letterman on the Netflix special about how the way that social media algorithms work, it feeds us information that affirms what we already think. You know, like if I don't trust Fox News, and I don't, but I get my news from more, I don't know, less right, less conservative sources. then I'm going to see more of that. I'm going to see a lot more of those types of stories that reinforce my value system as a liberal, as someone who, I'm pro-gay rights and I'm pro-choice and I'm pro-social programs to help the poor and I'm anti-death penalty and all this stuff. And I despise Trump and all those things. And so because that's the type of stuff that interests me, I essentially am programming the social media machine to continue to feed that stuff back to me. And so now you're in a culture, a cycle where you're sending and receiving the same stuff all the time. And, the people who believe Sean Hannity at Fox News are doing the same thing, sending and receiving the same stuff. And the people who watch Alex Jones are doing the same thing. And the people who, who have a certain, narrow perspective, who are part of a certain tribe, they are sending and receiving the same stuff. And we become these little microcosms. We become islands unto ourselves in some ways. And this feeds into the us versus them narrative out there. It feeds into the petty sort of tribalistic tendencies that human beings just generally have. I mean, we just do. Human beings are by nature tribalistic. Us, them, right? In group, out group. And I've seen it the way many atheists deal with religious people. I mean, a huge swath of religious people on this planet, billions of people who believe in God in some way, 2 billion plus Christians, a ton of professing Christians here in the United States. And yet when they speak about Christians, they are the other. They're not three-dimensional human beings who might genuinely be good people trying to live good lives. They're simply products of family and culture. They genuinely want to do the right thing. They're just sort of the victims of bad ideas when it comes to religious ideology, but they're not bad people. No, not everybody who is a God believer in the Christian church is out there trying to strip rights away from women or, are trying to keep gay people from getting married. The fundamentalists certainly are. But there are a lot of other people who, they practice a different brand, sort of a self-guided brand of Christianity. A lot of people self-fashion their own Jesus and their own framework for belief. And, they're not interested in taking rights away from anybody else. They believe because it makes them happy. They're social Christians. And if you met them on the street, they'd give you the coat off their back and they would invite you into their homes, and they're people of generosity and kindness and good humor. There's no room for that kind of nuance when we live in a binary culture, an us-them tribalistic in-group, out-group culture. There's no room for that. But how in the world are we supposed to engage and convince people if we can't have a relationship with them? We can't have a conversation with them. And for throwing stones over the fence all the time. Just throwing stones all the time. We're right, you're wrong, we're better than you, you're worse than us, we're superior, you're inferior. What was that article that was talking about the mindset of many people, especially online? Hell, I've seen a ton of this in atheist circles. It's kind of a fringe atheist circle, but the narrative is if you disagree with me, you're wrong. And if you're wrong, you're bad. And if you're bad, you're trash. And that's how we see people who disagree with us. You're not just wrong. We don't just disagree. You're trash. You're garbage. How do we get there? And already, whoever hears me say that is rushing out to find the worst of the worst example and saying, well, are you saying so-and-so isn't trash? And that's not even remotely what we're talking about. We're not existing here on the fringes. I'm not talking about the people who genuinely go out and demonstrate hatred and awfulness and bigotry and all these. You're now not listening. You're rushing off to find some example to try to demonstrate that you're right. I'm trying to listen to me. Listen to me. Can someone disagree with me and be a good person? Can someone disagree on important subjects and not be human garbage? My brother-in-law, one of the best people I know. Hey, he's He is a, he has the biggest heart of almost anybody I know. Devout Christian, Baptist, Bible believing Baptist. We totally disagree on theology. And we've had, he's one of the only people in my whole family we've gotten together and we're talking, you know, we're able to disagree and still engage and respect and love each other. And so we'll talk about the Bible and the validity of Scripture and Jesus and the teachings of Christ and the evidence for and against Jesus, or, you know, what science says about evolution. We'll get into all those things and we'll have a passionate debate, you know, defending our positions and trying to be understood and heard. And at the end, big hug. It's so good to see you. Catch you next week. I like him more than I like most atheists. He believes in God. Is he human garbage? Is he trash? Is he the other? Is he the out-group? How in the world do he and I put away the bad ideas and embrace the better ideas if we're not willing to talk to each other? Hell, I see that right now with my mother and father. We don't even speak. Right? I mean, they've shut down. You know, no one's listening. No headway is made. How's that happen? Can I sit in the same room with somebody who is a, you know, a political conservative, if I'm a tree-hugging liberal, and we can be friendly? Can we stand on the same stage and have a conversation like civilized people? You know, I'm reminded of Christopher Hitchens. You know, he went out and he had conversations, cordial conversations, with people who were diametrically opposed to him in almost every single way. And he always came off with good humor and strength and verve. And, you know, it was about the exchange of ideas. Not once did he look at someone at the podium across the stage and say, "You're garbage. You're shit. You're trash. You're awful. You're subhuman." I married a Christian. Not always easy. People are very curious. They've asked me, you know, would you put Natalie on the air sometime? Would she want to do a radio show with you? And the spotlight isn't really her thing. Maybe someday. If we do it, I'll probably have somebody else come in and just talk to us as a couple instead of, I don't want to set it up so that I'm interviewing my wife, you know. Honey, tell me about this. You know, I don't want to do that. But it'd be more like, you know, I'll have Dillahunty or somebody come in and, you know, he could just get us talking and then keep both of us honest as we play off each other. You know, we've had our moments when ideologically we are, you know, we're from different nations and we're frustrated. We don't feel like we're being heard or understood, or I'm making it so plain and so clear. If you just listen to me, I know you'd get it. You know, we talk about different things and we've affected each other. You know, she softened my harder edges over the years. When I first left the faith, I was pretty pissed off about all the time I'd wasted and about how tremendously condescending the faith was to me when it had essentially no foundation to stand on. You know, all the platitudes and the damage done and going after the kids, and there's a church on every half block, and I was just irritated. In fact, you can see that in the temperature of my work back in the early days. There's a lot more sarcasm there, and I'm just, you know, a little more teeth and all my stuff. And some people say they miss, but I've softened. And not everything's a battle, not everything's a fight, not everything's an excuse to jump up in the air and wave my fist. I mean, I used to be horrible. I'd see something on television, and it would be insane. It's whatever I saw. And I would just about have a fit. I'd be like, "This is an outrage." And, you know, Natalie would just look at me like, you cannot fix that. You know, you're not going to be able to fix every problem in the world. This is something activists struggle with. And conversely, I've given her a perception, a window into what godlessness is that she never before would have seen. She's very kind to say that I'm, in her mind, the best man she knows. Years ago, if she had been told that she would have not just an atheist in her life, but she would be married to an atheist and he would be the best man she knows, she would have never believed it. She didn't associate. She didn't really know if she had atheists in her life. She didn't know who they were. She had this sort of picture of the angry atheist, the pissed off vitriolic atheist that's always going after people. She had the stereotype, but she didn't know. And so now imagine, I mean, hell, she's going with me this weekend to the American Atheist National Convention. She's going to come with me. She's not even an atheist. She's going to help me run the table, and she's going to be there for my 50th birthday broadcast just to support me. And she's, wow. You know, she has seen the goodness without gods, and she has seen beautiful people accepted for who they are. And she, in terms of values, actually lines up with me that we don't go around judging people and putting them in a box, but we celebrate the diversity of humanity. And people have a right to live their own lives on their own terms, to pursue truth on their own terms, which is kind of my shtick, right? It's what I've been trying to tell my family for so many years. We can disagree, but I've earned the right to live my own life and pursue truth on my own terms. I'm genuinely interested in truth, whatever it is. And if God shows up tomorrow, I promise I will do my best to approach that evidence honestly. Natalie gets it. So while she and I disagree, I respect her right to be who she is. And she very much respects and supports my right to be me. Seth, be you at the volume that you choose. Pursue what you're passionate about. Be who you are. You know, and I still love that guy, is what she's saying. I mean, that's something that, it's a human thing, not a religious thing, not a Christian thing to do. It's a human thing to do. We have this sort of weird gap between us that some people say, you know, how do you make it work? And I'm like, well, despite the fact that it's sometimes very difficult, the goodness far outweighs the bad. And we are an example of two people who can really disagree about something critical in our lives, but we never sacrificed each other's humanity on the altar. You know, we never sort of declared the other and then said, you know what, you disagree with me, you're wrong. If you're wrong, you're bad. If you're bad, you're trash. And I would have been cheated out of the opportunity to know her and to have my life, you know, connected to her in that way. So, I don't know, I was struck by the kindness of Malala Yousafzai last night. I don't know if, you know, I would never tell anyone to forgive an attacker, someone who had harmed you. That's not my place. I don't know in my own life if I could ever do it. But I will say that I was tremendously struck by the depth and the maturity and the capacity that this young woman had to be able to say, I won't be chained to hate, and I am going to commit myself to the good. And not only do I want to see the oppressed freed, but I also want to see the oppressor free. That's, I don't know, that is something that I hope it sticks with me for a long time. And I hope it continues to affect how I engage in the world. We'll always be out there kind of doing battle against those we disagree with in some way, but there's a reminder there that we're all the human condition, we're all people. And the minute we dehumanize each other, then we're just throwing labels at labels. We're just escalating for the sake of escalation. We're simply reinforcing our microcosm. We're not going to fix anything. We're simply going to live our lives angry and in frustration. Do we want to be right? Is right being right enough, or do we want to be effective? Do we want to change minds? Do we want to help people? Do we want to change the world? I think I'd like to change the world. I think I would like to. I'd like to find the guy who was like me 30 years ago, immersed in magical thinking, indoctrinated with bad science, bad history, bad theology, bad ideas, bad notions about the world, the galaxy, the universe, bad notions about humanity, to find that person and just give them the encouragement to pursue the questions, embrace the doubts, tap on the glass, get curious, challenge the opposition, challenge the assumption and see where that chain of evidence takes you in the hopes that they will discover a brand new and much better world. That's what drives me. So that's what this broadcast is sort of about today, an encouragement to you that, you know, we're all going to get frustrated, but we're all people, flawed, but I think mostly good people. And as we continue to do what we do, it's my hope that we don't sacrifice our own humanity as we argue and fight passionately for, you know, the things we care deeply about, for the input and the support and the encouragement that you have been in my life. And you will never know the contribution. You will never know the sense of community and encouragement and challenge and family even that you brought to me. Your humanity has shown me a better life, much better life than I ever received in the faith. I mean, you know, we sat in church and went through the motions, but it's when you get rid of all the window dressing and you just start being human beings for the sake of being human beings. And when I see people, I see you at the American Atheist Convention, big hug, it's good to see you. Thank you for everything you do for me. Thanks for everything you do for them. And we have those moments of human connection. We're reminded that, you know, we're all the human race. And this is the one shot, the one life, the one planet, the one, you know, the one opportunity we have. Let's make the most of it. I'd rather spend it building bridges than barbecuing them, for sure. And I hope you feel the same. Let's go out and build some bridges wherever we can. It's not always possible. Let's build some bridges wherever we can. Let's build some people up. Let's see people in three dimensions. Let's spread some love and let's show them that, you know, no God's required to have a wonderful existence here on this planet. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching, and I will see you soon.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.